You're listening to a special edition of Midori House from Frieze Art Fair, first broadcast on the 9th of October 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Midori House, being as it is beamed to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up over the next hour, I'll be joined by arts journalist Gareth Harris to give us his take on this year's event so far, the very first of its kind. We'll also hear from gallerist Edmondo de Robolant on selling Italian masters in a very new space. And Axel Weervoort will also be joining me to describe which work he's displaying under this handsome tent. Plus, James Brett from the Gallery of Everything will be letting us know what's up his always mysterious sleeve. We'll hear from collector Jason Lee on shopping for art. And to round off the show, we'll be joined by the brains behind the event, director of Frieze Masters, Victoria Siddle. All that, plus we might play some great music too. All to come here on the next packed hour on Midori House. But first, let's cross back to our studios just down the road in Marylebone to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Representatives of the survivors of the Srebrenica genocide have arrived in Strasbourg today. They will file an appeal at the European Court of Human Rights to overturn a ruling by the Dutch Supreme Court that the United Nations cannot be prosecuted for failing to prevent genocide against Bosnian Serbs in Srebrenica near the end of Bosnia's war in 1995. Well, Axel Hageldoorn is a lawyer representing the families of those victims.
And we think the Dutch state, through the Dutch Supreme Court, violated human rights and access to a court and the fair trial principle of the European Convention on Human Rights by doing this. And therefore, we apply at the European Court to get the European Court to decide about this.
In Greece, violent clashes between protesters and police were briefly interrupted today when a man braved the raining rocks and tear gas and ran stark naked through the streets of Athens to a cheering crowd. Greek police fired tear gas and wielded batons at demonstrators throwing stones and petrol bombs in central Athens to protest a visit by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She was meeting the Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras only a few hundred feet away from the clashes. Tens of thousands of austerity-weary Greeks took to the streets in one of the biggest protests in months. NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has commended Turkey's restraint, a country which last week faced continuous shelling from Syrian government forces near the border, saying the military alliance had the necessary plans to defend Turkey against any attack.
I would like to commend the Turkish government for the restraint it has shown in its response to the completely unacceptable Syrian attacks on Turkey. Obviously, Turkey has a right to defend herself within international law.
Here, British surgeons have removed a teenager's stomach to save her life after she drank a cocktail made with liquid nitrogen during a night out with friends. The 18-year-old woman was rushed to hospital in Lancaster, where she was diagnosed with a perforated stomach. Gastroenterologist Colin Harris said the operation went well.
She should be able to live a relatively normal life. She'll have to eat smaller meals more frequently, perhaps have to take some nutritional supplements, but she should be able to live a relatively normal life.
The US Army's 170th Infantry Brigade Combat Team is bidding farewell to Germany today at a ceremony signifying the final deactivation of the military union. Some 4,000 US soldiers have been stationed at Baumholder Garrison for several decades. The move comes as part of sweeping defence cuts of nearly $500 billion announced by the Pentagon in January. The team's commander, Colonel Mark Raschke, said their experiences in Germany had also helped them on other assignments.
The experience in Germany was phenomenal. We had a chance to partner with our German leaders here, and that partnership actually helped us when we worked for a German division headquarters down in Afghanistan. And so I think that leaders at all levels really learned a lot from the partners we have here.
And finally, a package of diaries said to have been posted to the United States from Britain in the 1960s could provide a vital clue to the origin of a controversial portrait presented in Geneva last month as Leonardo da Vinci's original Mona Lisa. But in a twist typical of the intrigue-prone world of art, the diaries, notes from by early 20th century British connoisseur and collector Hugh Blaker, have disappeared, and the Washington address they were sent to seems to have never have existed. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's 5 minutes past six here, and you're tuned in to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Freeze Masters right here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, va Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London, cara.
London으로부터.
From London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's Monocle 24 and this is Midori House. I'm Robert Bowne. We're coming to you live from the Freeze Masters Art Fair in the slightly chilly Regent's Park. We're sort of situated on the edge of the Freeze Masters Art Fair. But it's a good place to be, whether we're here or not. We're sort of revved up and ready to go. It's Tuesday, the 9th of October 2012. 3 hours ago, the doors opened to press and VIPs for this inaugural Freeze Masters Art Fair here in Regent's Park. It's the first year that this event, which features over 90 of the world's leading galleries, has taken place alongside the Contemporary Art Fair further down the park. It's designed to explore the relationship between old and new art, covering anything from ancient Egypt to the year 2000. Not to miss out, we're right here in the centre of the action, broadcasting live. So wherever you are in the world, welcome to today's Midori House with me, Robert Bowne. Welcome to my first guest, editor-at-large for the art newspaper, Gareth Harris, who's been writing about the fair and the lead-up to the event. Gareth, welcome to our slightly chilly outpost on the corner of Freeze Masters.
Quite chilly, I have to say, in Regent's Park, but absolutely fascinating to come down to the fair and see what's going on.
We offered you coconut water to start off with, right? Now, this is not something that warms the cockles of anyone's heart, so I'm sorry about that. It'll get better as the show goes on.
It's fine. It's certainly refreshing me.
And what about the art fair? Freeze is famous for having four or five shades of grey. People now think that that's associated with sexiness, don't they? But maybe they're putting a zero on the end of it. But there are five shades of grey about which you can set your pictures on. How are people dealing with that?
I think it's been very successful. I mean, it's a very handsome fair. It's very elegant. And as you say, there are 99 dealers showing works made before the year 2000. So it's a real mix from tribal art to modern masters to old masters. And I think it all looks quite elegant, I have to say. There are some amazing juxtapositions across the different stands. I've not been here very long, but I've seen some really quite startling things. I mean, there are some 13th century gargoyles on the dealer Sam Fogg stand, and then you kind of walk across the way and you can see a vitrine of Robert Gober's works from the 1990s with a candle, a newspaper and a shoe. And these contrasts are quite startling, you know, they really do work, I think, in this setting. There's a very good section called Spotlight, which concentrates on 20th century art, which has got some fascinating works by the Italian artist, povero artist Pier Paolo Calzolari. There's a fantastic sort of linen installation by Ligia Pape just across the way as well. So I think on first impressions, I have to say, it seems to work and you know, it looks successful to me.
And you talked about some sort of juxtapositions, some canny juxtapositions between old stuff and more contemporary stuff, newer stuff. Have any people tried to sort of draw a line from the old to the new in the things that they have on their stand, or by the very fact that certain galleries are cheek by jowl with each other?
I think the very fact that cheek by jowl does obviously, you know, make those sort of juxtapositions stand out. But I noticed there was a fantastic photo of Louise Bourgeois by Annie Leibovitz on the Bernheimer stand. They mixed that in with lots of old masters. So, you know, it is a real mix and match, and it is working from what I've seen so far. And what's very interesting is there's a younger demographic here. This was the aim of the organisers, They very much wanted to get a younger crowd in, a trendier crowd. And from what I've seen this afternoon, they've succeeded. You know, there's a younger demographic. I find it very interesting that they are standing and studying old masters, possibly for the first time. They may be looking at a Lucas Cranach work, like a John Curran contemporary piece. And I think that's fascinating. And, you know, it is absorbing as well. I think to bring old masters to that younger audience is quite something, and it seems to be happening, you know, in the fair.
And in terms of the market, does this feel like the right time to be doing it? I mean, obviously, younger buyers tend to want newer stuff, contemporary stuff, the stuff that maybe makes the headlines, or diffusion lines of the stuff that makes the headlines. Having sort of a younger crowd turning up for the art fair is fine. Do you think their pockets are deep enough?
That's a very interesting question. I suppose the price points at Frieze Masters might be higher than over at Frieze London, the contemporary fair. So, for example, I know on Thomas Gibson Fine Art, he's offering Giacometti works for around £2.5 million. So, obviously, you need very deep pockets for some things. I think the price points over on at the contemporary fair will be slightly lower. But this is a trend that collectors are tapping into. I mean, crossover collecting is nothing new. It's gone on for centuries. Henry Frick collected, you know, Renaissance works and ivories around 1915. It's not a new phenomenon. But I think it's very canny of the organisers to, as I said, tap into this trend. And, you know, I think there is a market there. I think the auction houses have been doing this for a long time. They've been identifying high net worth clients that collect across different genres and eras. And I know at Christie's, for example, they say that their high net worth clients often collect across 8 different categories, which is fascinating. So the auction houses have been there for a while. They've been doing this for a long time, and the fairs are now catching up. And you know, there are plenty of other fairs in the crowded fair landscape that have tried to do this. Yeah. TEFAF Maastricht is the obvious example. That's the granddaddy of European fairs. That's not quite succeeded because the modern contemporary section isn't as strong, and whereas here they've obviously tried to mix things up and they are determined to bring in this younger audience. And from what I've seen today, yeah, you know, so far it's working.
Yeah, we talking about the TEFAF in Maastricht, as you said, the granddaddy. What is he? I don't know. He's sort of like the Santa Claus. He's certainly a big fat man with a beard, I tend to think.
You mean TEFAF
and such? Right.
Yeah, I mean, it was the silver anniversary this year. It's a destination fair. There's not really much else going on in Maastricht, so you have to head straight for the fair. And it's really the place where you dig out the old masters.
And it's very different in terms of the framing of the pictures, in terms of the kind of the landscape. This is a very different, it's a plush place, isn't it? We're going to have Axel Vervoort on later on.
Oh, okay.
Who, again, is sort of one of the granddaddies of the dealers that turns up at Maastricht. It's very
exactly.
much his back garden.
Yeah.
And it's interesting seeing normally a man with a sort of taste for the lavish, the Rococo, the Baroque and the gilt.
Yes.
Seeing him use these sort of 5 colours of grey to frame his work.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing in itself, right?
It is. And, you know, TEFAF, the sections are very clearly defined, and it's massive. It's much bigger than Frieze Masters, actually. So here, you know, this strategy of mixing things, you know, as we say, mixing up the different genres does seem to be a deliberate ploy, which will appeal, I suppose, to the younger audience. But you're right, TEFAF is grander, I have to say. Dealers tend to keep back their best works in stock for TEFAF, which is very noticeable when you go there. The quality of the works is fantastic. The works here so far I've seen aren't as impressive as in Maastricht, but there's still a long way to go, and it's early days, obviously. I think the first year will be very successful. The real test with new fairs is always the second year.
And I wanted to ask you on that point. We've wandered around and done some interviews with some gallerists, and they've had some pretty broad smiles on their faces. We know some things have sold. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that they feel comfortable in this slightly more contemporary setting? I was going to use the word austere, but I shouldn't use that.
I think they do, yes. I mean, the galleries I've spoken to a few New York dealers, they really feel that this fair fills a niche. They think it's an interesting move by Frieze because it's a secondary market fair. The Frieze art fair, the original art fair, is a primary market fair, so it works fresh to the market. I think, you know, Frieze had to reinvent itself to a certain degree, and they've done it with this fair. They really have, by branching into the secondary market and the dealers. In that way, it can attract dealers that haven't been able to access the other fair. As a New York dealer said to me just before I came in to do this interview, you know, all good work, all excellent works end up on the secondary market. And he's right, you know, anything that's of any good, of any value, of any worth, will, I guess, be sold on. So this is an extremely clever move.
There's a sort of honesty about that.
Yeah, there is, definitely, definitely. And I've seen some amazing people outside. Chris Durkon, who's head of Tate Modern. I've seen Keith Tyson, the artist. I've seen some really high-profile collectors, you know, around the floor. There's lots of curators around, which is very interesting because obviously, you know, they're obviously looking for museum-quality works for the collections. So, yes, it's an interesting mix out there.
And just finally, before we go, Gareth, we talked before we switched the mics on about, are there any masterpieces at Frieze Masters? And whether this is accessible or not, I wonder what has jumped out to you that does belong in a museum.
I think the gargoyles are very impressive. Everyone's levitating towards those, and it's quite...
You're not being rude about someone. These are actual pieces. This is on Sam Fogg's standard.
Yeah, I'm not talking about collectors. No, wizened collectors, I should say. No, they seem to be a bit of a talking point. I've yet to sort of isolate old masters as such that I would want to sort of pick up off the shelf, but
Gareth Harris's checkbook remains unflexed for the time being. Gareth, thank you very much.
Thanks
for
so
joining
much.
Us on Midori House. That was Gareth Harris, editor at large for the Art Newspaper, and you're tuned in to Midori House, coming to you live from Frieze Masters in Regent's Park. You're tuned in, therefore, of course, to Monocle 24. We'll be back after this short break with more from the fair. Stay tuned.
Second Cycle is a special kind of upscaling that understands consumers' connection to objects with a personal history. Monocle Films travel to Helsinki to watch Finnish furniture brand Artek hunt down old items and bring them back to life.
It was quite an emotional thing for all of us. When we went through the flea markets and schools and kindergarten from where we bought these things, we took them to our office and our employees started to say that Mirko, don't do anything to them. Don't touch them, don't hurt them. Let them be as they are.
You can watch this Second Cycle film and many more films in the program's menu on monocle.com.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
And you're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from Frieze Masters, the art fair in London, with me, Robert Bound. We're investigating what the galleries are hanging on their walls here at the fair. We're talking about the buzz of the place, and we're opening a few bottles of something to help ourselves along the way too, as we make like a gallery and refresh ourselves appropriately. One of the gallerists exhibiting at Frieze Masters this year is Edmondo de Robelant, co-founder of Robelant and Voena, a rather palatial gallery on London's Dover Street that deals in old masters and 19th century French and Italian works. I met up with Edmondo earlier to see what he has on display. Edmondo, we've kind of caught you in the middle of a bit of a rush. We're just about an hour into the fair, the inaugural Frieze Masters. He looks at his watch to check, and I think we're just about right.
Absolutely.
And you've been jumping from Italian into English again. At what point is the most critical in the fair for you? Is this sort of when you get a rush of collectors coming in, a lot of familiar faces?
I think quite honestly that the most exciting moment, the most important moment, is sometime during the VIP opening. Whether it's early or late, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know. I think we're open till about 9 o'clock this evening. Most likely it'll be sort of post-work hours.
That's a very unionised art world. I never see that coming.
That's not quite what I meant. But I think that already within this 1 hour, we've seen some very important people come round, and you know, it's a bit of a lottery to know whether people will make the effort to come this far away. I mean, obviously the name Frieze is sufficient to attract all sorts of people that wouldn't normally come to other fairs, and we participate in a number of London fairs, namely Masterpiece, this one, and it's a very, very different atmosphere all of a sudden. So
yeah,
very
nice
exciting
to know what sort of how the atmosphere changes. Does this feel like a bit of a fresh air blowing through the fallen leaves of Regent's Park for galleries such as yourselves that don't exhibit, aren't part of the Frieze family, which is obviously known for contemporary art? Is it a very, very different way of dealing with people?
Well, you've got to remember that though we're not in the Fries family per se, we do hundreds of fairs a year. So it's a formula that we know quite well. There's usually a huge rush at the beginning. If it's over the first weekend, normally most of the business is done over that weekend. And then there's quite a lot of sort of loiterers and people who just want to come to see the pictures as they would in a museum or whatever it is. But the first sort of 48 hours, 72 hours of a fair are pivotal and critical, I would have thought.
And in terms of the stuff that's hanging on your walls here today, you're obviously well known for Italian and French, 17th century, right up there. There's also, you're bringing it up to date with this Lucio Fontana and Morandi on the walls. Is that a conscious decision to sort of make a timeline through the stuff that you're interested in, that your clients might be interested in, or is that to attract new people?
Well, it's since a number of years that we've tried to bridge the gap between old, modern, and sometimes contemporary as well. Obviously, we haven't brought anything contemporary here because the fair stops at the year 2000. But we've made a conscious effort to expand our horizon, not only because obviously then you can find a number of clients in both camps, but also because we've found that quite recently a lot of our old master clients were stretching out into modern and into contemporary, and not to lose them to other people, we thought it was wiser to get into a world that we knew, not professionally, but you know, it's a world that we followed for many, many years, and now we've sort of started doing it from a professional point of view as well.
That sort of thing, hanging the newer stuff along with the old, does that open up some curatorial thought for you as well? I mean, can you draw a line from one thing to another? Is that something that you try to do, or are you looking to put your best stuff on sale at this time of year?
There's a bit of that. Obviously, one wants to put the best stuff that one has, but also you've got to bear in mind that you're doing it in a very constricted space, and so you're going from the 17th century to the end of the 20th century in 80 square meters of space. You have to make some concessions. Sometimes it works, other times it doesn't work quite as well. I mean, it's up to you as a visitor to tell me whether you think that the things jar or whether you think that the things work quite well together.
It's a beautiful display, and it's one of those things. It looks very much like looks like it's a thing of quality, doesn't it? Rather than make it maybe drawing a line from one thing to another.
Well, I mean, we try to obviously have the best things in the fields that we operate in, and we do, as you see, a lot of 18th century view paintings, and I think we are amongst the sort of two or three companies who really have the best things in that respect. In modern and contemporary, we are still neophytes, and we still have very good things, but obviously our depth of presentation is less than maybe other people who've been doing it for many years.
And I wonder finally, Edmondo, whether like a boxer you have a pre-match routine. Is there anything that you do? Is there a superstition you have before you come to a fair in order to have a good time and make good sales? Is there anything that you always do?
To be absolutely honest, there's always a mad rush at the last minute because one's forgotten one's prices, one's labels, the book, the thing. I mean, there's always some drama that's happening up to the 11th minute of the 11th hour. So to just get it all looking professional and together is the aim, and most times we just about manage it.
And that was gallerist Edmondo de Roblant talking to me early at Fries Masters. And this is Midori House, coming to you live from Fries Masters here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. Now, one of the big talking points of this art fair in its very first year was how the cool, clean, very contemporary aesthetic of the regular Fries fair would accommodate the Baroque stylings of some of the galleries that deal in antiquities, old masters and the like. Our next guest, Axel Veervoort, has a signature style that is often ornate, occasionally Byzantine, always interesting and eyeball-pleasing. How did he get on with the austere Fries scheme of things? Axel, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
You made a face while I was describing your work there. You better put the record straight before we start.
No, it's okay the way you say, because I think all my life been interesting, you know, to
to collect at the same time antique art and contemporary art. And I think I was only 21 when I discovered Fontana through my friend Jeff Ryan, who was a painter as well. And this spatial concept, you know, of the emptiness and the space and the silence, which I could not find in old art immediately. But I was thinking, after being more, you know, being interested in all this zero movement, all the contemporary art of the 50s and the 60s, everything that happened after the destruction of all the walls in Japan, in Europe and everywhere. So all those artists who said we have to start from nothing, I get more and more excited them then. And their dimension I did not find back in old art. But the old art I always loved still. And I looked in the sky of a Turner, like a contemporary Chiraga, or I could see even an early still life, you know, the distance between the objects, like, you know, there's a, I sometimes looked more like to the empty spaces than to the things which are painted themselves. I think it's more all about energy of art, of the spirituality of art, you know, what art changes you. But I think art does change you. Living with art is looking like in a mirror, and at the end you start resembling it, and it creates you, gives you another dimension. That's why I think always very wealthy people always have been surrounded by art, and this is of all histories.
And I wondered, you seem to be one of the people that is best placed to draw a line from the old to the new. There are things, just having a look around your stand earlier this afternoon, there's a Lucio Fontana, and there's Egyptian artifacts from the Ptolemaic dynasty, and there's a very fascinating piece which is an army tank mask that someone in the French army would have worn.
This is like an odd piece. It's like with the humor.
Yeah.
But I think it's lovely. I think you have to look like to art like a fresh-born child who knows nothing and knows no price, no prejudgment. You just have to look at things what speaks to you, you know, what makes you curious, what gives you another dimension in your life, and that's all about art. I think that's why this is the biggest excitement to live with art. And I think the Frieze normally is a great fair because a lot of contemporary art is of new things to discover. There's the, you know, you think I'm going to discover the new one that nobody knows yet, and that's why I think Frieze is very interesting. It's always been so interesting, and people are very excited to go to the opening. But I think Frieze Masters too, next to it, is a wonderful combination, I think. Because here you have more important artists who made already their career, who are very influenceable. You will see in Frieze Masters young people who are totally influenced by people you will see in Frieze Masters. You know, so there is this interaction which I think makes it very interesting. And I'm so pleased this happens in London, because I think really London needed a fair like this, you know.
Well, that's the thing. We were saying that Maastricht, the TEFAF fair in Maastricht, is very much in your sort of back garden. And I wondered how the two sort of compare in terms of maybe the atmosphere, because this is very much a new thing for London, a fair like this with a lot of clout that is selling stuff that isn't contemporary or modern.
No, Maastricht is a very classical fair, where little by little we introduce more and more contemporary. And then Basel is almost contemporary. But I think to do the mix as a purpose, like Frieze Masters, is quite unique. And I think that's why I think this fair will have an enormous future. But it is, for me, it's not competition with Maastricht or with Basel. They all have their own character, and they're all spirituality, and they all are very strong in their kind. So I think it is going to make the same way. That's what's my feeling.
And I'd like to know how, as we said, you're very well known at the Maastricht Fair for having a lavish stand. Now here, you're not allowed to have one. You've got to be rather more strict with your aesthetic, Axel.
Did that
sort of change the way you looked at the works that you were going to display this year?
Yes, absolutely, because I think also in the old art we expose here, for me it's like timeless art. It's like a Cycladic head or the Yemen head you liked very much, you know. For me this is contemporary art, but it's 4,000 years old, and I think in the life of the stars, were millions of years, 100 years or 1,000 years, nothing, you know. And so I think all good art stays contemporary, you know, and this is all, and this what I really wanted to express in this fair. And it's more exposed like you would expose in an exhibition or a museum, because there's no furniture, it's not to live with, you know. it's another conception. But in my booth, I think every a piece has a relationship with the other. There's a dialogue, there's something, why did put them together, why their spirituality could be friends, you know, and why one plus one makes more than two, you know, because sometimes two people together as well are much stronger than one by himself. And I think with art it's the same.
And I wanted to ask you about your shows at the Palazzo Fortuny during the Venice Biennale. Kind of do this thing where they sort of throw up the Scrabble set of your different pieces in your collection and let them sort of fall down. Obviously, in an artful way, in a very well thought out way.
No, it's not.
But there's a lot of juxtaposition, isn't there?
But it's not because of the juxtaposition. It's never for an aesthetic reason. I think every exhibition I do in Palazzo Fortuny is like 2 years preparation, philosophical. Salons which are organized with scientific people, with people in the music world, in the contemporary world, in old world, you know, to find a synthesis, you know, and then we work on the theme almost 1 year and a half, and on the and to choose, and then once we got the theme very right, we choose the art. And I think nothing is just thrown like that. I think everything has been thought and has a reason to be there, and it's a competition. But it's, I work with it till it looks extremely natural, that nothing has been done forced or to show or to be better. I think that there always should be kind of humbleness in it as well, that things are just there, you know, they not always have all the spotlights.
And I want to ask you finally before we go, Axel, it's always a pleasure to see something that you've put on display. And you mentioned that way of always trying to sort of look at it through sort of childlike eyes.
Yes.
Reinvigorate a bit of childishness in the way that you look at things. When you walk around here today, do you see a similar spirit of trying to put things together with a lot of learning, but with a bit of a light heart?
Not everywhere, you know, I must be honest. You know, some people really have another mentality, and in their own right, you know, they want to show the piece in the best way, put all the spots on it, you know, and put it in. But I think when the work of art is great, it can support a lot, you know, it's still fabulous. Yeah? But it's not my way of... I think it's also interesting to discover things and to feel them, that they come and speak to you. Because sometimes too many spotlights on them creates too much a distance, I think.
Axel Weervoort should be the spokesman for Regent's Park generally. thank you very much for joining us, yeah. Axel. It is 6:31 p.m. here in London, and we are Midori House coming to you live from Frieze Masters in London. We'll be back in a sec.
LDNTYO. NYC.
In the next half hour of the show here from Frieze Masters, we'll be talking to James Brett about his Museum of Everything and his Gallery of Everything, and we'll hear from the director of Frieze Masters, Victoria Siddle. But first, let's cross back to our London studios at Midori House to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much, Rob. Representatives of the survivors of the Srebrenica genocide have arrived in Strasbourg today. They'll file an appeal at the European Court of Human Rights to overturn a ruling by the Dutch Supreme Court that the United Nations cannot be prosecuted for failing to prevent genocide against Bosnian Serbs in Srebrenica near the end of Bosnia's war in 1995. Greek police have fired tear gas and wielded batons at demonstrators, throwing stones and petrol bombs in central Athens to protest a visit by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She's meeting Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras only a few hundred feet away from the clashes. NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has commended Turkey's restraint, a country which last week faced continuous shelling from the Syrian government forces near the border, saying the military alliance had the necessary plans to defend Turkey against attack. Here, British surgeons have removed a teenager's stomach to save her life after she drank a cocktail made with liquid nitrogen during a night out with friends. The 18-year-old woman was rushed to hospital in Lancaster. And the US Army's 170th Infantry Brigade combat team of 4,000 soldiers is bidding farewell to Germany today at a ceremony in Bauholden, signifying the final deactivation of the military union. The move comes as part of sweeping defence cuts of nearly $500 billion announced by the Pentagon in January. And those are the stories for the moment on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, where we're beaming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London. I'm Robert Bounds. As you'll know, if you listen to the first half of the show, we're trying to paint you a picture of what on earth is going on here under the rather beautiful temporary structure in Regent's Park. We're speaking to gallerists, curators, great talkers. My next guest might just be all of those three things rolled into one. I shouldn't have stumbled over that. James Brett is a collector, the founder of the Museum of Everything, and now the Gallery of Everything here at Frieze Masters. To help define some of those things a little better and help us take the temperature of the fair, James joins us now. James, welcome to Midori House.
Afternoon, Rob.
I like that. I thought we were going to say something else. I thought something else was going to happen then.
No, I managed to get the words out. It sort of seemed to be okay.
It seemed to work. Now, this is all new for everyone. When the sort of ringer went and the VIPs and the collectors sort of walked into the fair 3 hours ago, no one quite knew what anything was going to look like, how it was going to feel. How does it feel for you having a stand for the first time, the Gallery of Everything?
Well, I quite like it. It's a hello, how are you exercise. There's a lot of that in multiple languages. And so I try and juggle between someone important I must talk to and my mother, who seems to have stayed at the stand with her grandson for about 4 hours, asking me all kinds of minutiae about my washing and how I'm keeping and if I'm okay after going to Russia, and using it really as an opportunity to catch up. So it's been a good personal fair for me so far.
So, but you're not trying to sell any of the latter, only the former?
I'm not selling the washing, although I'm open to it.
and you better tell us what's on your stand. We've talked in the first half of the show about a bit of a mashup between the ancient and the modern. What can we see at the Gallery of Everything?
Well, the Gallery of Everything is sort of, I'd like to call it a radical initiative in a not so radical situation. But when I heard that Matthew and Amanda were creating Frieze Masters, I thought it was an opportunity to do a great show first and foremost, and to pick out certain artists who had somehow been overlooked by the world, and particularly by the museum curatorial world, but who were phenomenal. So I've been talking a lot lately about the alternative history of art, which I absolutely believe exists, because it's everybody who made anything outside of the main educational or theoretical structures. And we show a lot of that at the Museum of Everything. We've done shows here in London. We just travelled to Moscow, and we're about to open a show in Paris. And none of those are selling shows. But there's a logic which seems illogical to me, which is that a museum should never be engaged in commerce, and also shouldn't have a relationship with collectors, any museum. And that doesn't sound right, because the greatest museums in the world were started by collectors.
And philanthropy is not a dirty word. This is, nothing would exist without it, right, in terms of the art world.
Absolutely not. I mean, the best, of course, for a big museum is money. And then second best is probably some artwork, although they're very picky. You'd be surprised what they reject.
It depends how you frame your notes.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to know someone, perhaps. But I thought much better a very transparent relationship with the market and say, okay, well, here's a gallery. We're going to show these two artists. They're phenomenal. You've never heard of them. They're resonant. If you want to buy them, fantastic. Any profit we make will go towards the museum activities. And if we don't sell, fantastic too, because actually we've done this great exhibition and showed 50,000 people these artists who nobody really knows about.
And looking around the show, the things on your stand obviously share a common sense of making, a sense of art being works of art that everything else in this fair shares. That's the deal, isn't it, of your curatorial kind of exercise at the Museum of Everything, at the Gallery of Everything?
Well, there is no invisible art, that's true. And
I know you're breaking down the snobbery between a masterpiece and a piece of something that's very popular and newish, and something that has been possibly unfairly maligned as not being art before.
Well, I have big theories, as you personally, I mean, you know, we talked about it over chicken soup, but I have big theories about why people make anything and what art is. And I, when I'm, you know, had a few drinks, I'll tell you that art doesn't exist and it's a fabrication of us mortals.
Well, so we've had someone ordered you a coffee. This is a radio show. What did you think was going to happen? Come on.
I'm sorry, you were near the cafe and I was racing post-cigarette. But you know, the question, look, we're in an art fair, it's called Masters, and it's purporting to sell masterworks before 2000. The question is, who is a master and what is a master, and who defined them as masters? So often we'll see something and a lot of us will agree that's a fabulous object, that's a fabulous artist, but that's only if we're allowed to see it, if we've had the opportunity to see it. And so the gatekeepers at museums, particularly in the past, it was very rigid. The example I'd give, obviously from our own stand, you know, I'll tell you a story, which is there's an African-American man. He's living in a small rural town. His family are wool slaves, and he takes menial labor all his life. And he joins a church and gets a calling from God. And God says, make something. Make something nice, William. And so he goes to the cemetery and starts carving using a railroad spike. He carves the tombstones, and then he starts making these creatures and people and interesting objects. And he's spotted by this woman, Louise Dahl-Wolf, who was a fashion photographer for Harper's Bazaar. She takes some snaps, takes them down to her pal, who works at the Museum of Modern Art, shows Alfred Barr, who's the boss, who really created the institution, and who firmly believes in this alternative history. He says, phenomenal, I see no colour, give that man a one-man show, and it's 1937. And the only reason that we don't know about it is he was an African-American in 1937. The show was buried by the critics because they weren't ready to accept this work. So it stayed within a very small circle. And I just thought, look, he's a genius. I love the work personally. We sourced some. We said, look, this is a great opportunity to present it to collectors, to museums, to curators, and see what happens.
And a story like that is becoming more and more important, it seems, when there's a race by collectors for certain works. Being able to tell a story, how important is that to, well, to your aesthetic as well, James? It seems like it's quite important as well.
Well, I love a story. I come from a film background, so yeah. I like a narrative. But, you know, the works that we tend to show don't come with a context, or an art school context. The metaphors are buried inside the work and in the people who made them, so the biography is really important, not to the point that it's more important than the work. If you don't like these sculptures, you don't like them. If you think they're rubbish, excellent.
But it's nice to be able to be throwing a rock into the mill pool of an art fair sometimes.
Well, I think it is a rock because actually if you look at modern history, black art didn't start until the 50s, yeah. Let's say. And here's a guy, you know, 20 years earlier, and a phenomenal guy. And why isn't he in MoMA now in the collection, or why isn't he in the Whitney? So actually, yes, I quite like that radical position.
I'd just like to point out, you weren't making a position, you weren't doing anything peculiar with your body.
It wasn't a physical
while
position.
You were doing that. It was, you were just getting close to the microphone.
I have been known to do a physical position, but yeah.
Before we go,
where are you going?
I'm not going. But before we go to the next item,
before I go.
Yeah. What?
Okay.
You can stay. There's plenty of things here, but you ordered a coffee.
I did, sorry.
How was Russia? Because you went and you took the Museum of Everything, went in a big red lorry and drove across Russia. Tell us about that.
It was nuts. I mean, it was nuts.
There's a siren coming now.
Well, actually, talking of Pussy Riot, it was phenomenal. And the best thing about it were the Russian people. And we went to these cities. We went to Nizhny Novgorod, Yekaterinburg, Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan. And we didn't. You and I talked before I left. I mean, I had no idea. 100 people a day came with all kinds of artwork, all self-taught. And we really tried to see if we could find some discoveries. And we completely did. We met a guy who's painted the same park for 15 years in Nizhny Novgorod. 4,000 paintings, one artwork, to try and contextualize what it means to be alive in that city at one period of time. We met a man in Moscow who makes secret codes out of master books, you know, like Master and Margarita is one of his classics. And he was an amateur bibliograph, and he was a code breaker in the war, and they've come together in this thing. The guy's homeless. This is how he communicates. We said, does anybody in the world understand your system? He said, no. I said, if you call it art, maybe we can persuade some people.
Someone's making something next door.
Last time I said that, they knocked down a wall of the museum. It just happened in Paris. In Paris, literally, there was a noise like that, and someone had sledgehammered the wall.
Well, I hope this isn't going to happen here. It's a tent, and that could be painful for us. And B, I think they're tossing the hugest salad of all time. That's what it sounds like.
I trust you, Rob. I trust Monocle Radio. I'm confident nothing will happen.
We're going to play out the song, James. It's a song of your choice.
I know.
I asked you if you wanted the Magical Mystery Tour. I thought it might be appropriate. You said no. I want something by Alice Coltrane. So we're going to have a song called Stopover in Bombay in 1 second. But for the time being, James Brett from the Gallery of Everything, thank you so much for joining us on Midori House.
Merci.
And here is Alice Coltrane with Stopover in Bombay. Thank you. And that faded beautifully. It was Stopover in Bombay by Alice Coltrane, and that was the choice of James Brett. He didn't want Magical Mystery Tour, I don't know why. And you're listening to Midori House. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair, where the champagne is flowing. It's 6:45 p.m. here in London. That means it's 13:45 lunchtime in New York. We'll be back right after this with more highlights from the fair. We'll speak to the woman who put the whole thing together. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models, and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all these are necessary to become a leader.
On the latest episode, we meet a business duo that established a knitwear brand using Mongolian cashmere. We drop in on the World Retail Congress, and we hear from a man who reinvented the figure of the chic, bespectacled, clever American.
We decided that we would put a search for and try to buy vintage frames or original frames from doctors across America that maybe have old stock.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
All right, welcome back. We are Midori House and we are live from Frieze Masters. We wandered around earlier with a mic looking for people with shopping lists in their hands, collectors. Jason Lee, originally from Singapore and now a London-based collector and curator, told us about his art fair strategy.
I want to talk about footwear of people at the fair. You've got something that you could run in that also supports some heavy walking.
Yes.
Is this a wise choice for someone touring Frieze Masters this year?
Of course, I think it's very important you wear something comfortable because you're going to do lots of walking. You have no idea like how much walking you're going to do. So.
And do you have a kind of, do you have a master plan? You're a collector and you're a curator, so you're walking around with sort of two different hats on.
Exactly.
How does that work? How's that worked so far this afternoon?
I basically walk around with an open mind, like most people here, because this is the first Frieze Master. Everyone, I don't know what to expect. I've done the spotlight. I find it quite interesting, very different.
And this is each where a gallery has a single presentation, a single artist.
Yes. And I'm just working my way. I'm halfway through. I love this booth, Halin Ahmed. I think it's one of my favorites.
We've got some sort of Miro mobiles in there.
An amazing Coda mobile.
Yeah.
Alessandra Coda.
And in terms of, lots of people have sort of been sort of people very sort of pleased with the aesthetics of it. They've only got five shades of grey to choose from all the rest of it for their backgrounds. What do you think, looking at some of these pictures, some old masters and some more modern works, do you think against this background the pictures really pop out?
I think it's a great combination, especially you can see they hang old masters and contemporary photographs or modern photographs together. Yeah. I think it actually works because these days collectors don't just look at one particular like genre or from a particular period. People travel, they see different things, cross-culture. So I think it's a very good idea that you place different kind of works like next to each other. I think it's very good.
And do you think there's a different atmosphere under the tent today, you know, bringing these sorts of gallerists and collectors together under a little bit more of a contemporary feeling structure, being part of the Frieze family? Do you think there is such a thing as that? Do you think it feels different?
I can still feel it's Frieze because you can still see the branding, the identity, but it's slightly different. It's I noticed the shade of grey that I read about before coming here. I think it's a very good move and something very different. Yeah.
And just finally, do you have a sort of very disciplined mode of walking around from one corner to the other so you don't miss anything, or are you a bit like a scattergun?
Yes, I do have a strategy. I just started from the edge and then work my way to the other end of the fair. So make sure I cover every booth.
So you try not to do too much window shopping. You have to be focused.
Well, it's hard to focus, but I try. Yeah, there are a lot to see. So,
Well, thanks a lot and have a good rest of Frieze Masters.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that was me speaking to Jason Lee earlier on about collector's strategy. Okay, you're listening to Midori House. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair, and I'm Robert Bound. This year is the first Frieze Masters event, and I think it's safe to say that no person's fingernails have been gnawed more intensely, nor one sigh of relief taken more genuinely than that of my next guest. Victoria Siddle is director of Frieze Masters, the brains behind the events, and I'm delighted to say she's taken time out of her hectic schedule. Oh, that was written down, but I sort of... it's an easy word to stumble over. To join us on Midori House. Victoria, welcome, and thanks for having us, by the way.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
The bit we're in is quite cold, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
But next year it'll be fine. We'll be...
Yeah, it's a reminder that we are actually
I think I can
park,
hear people's
though.
Helicopters taking off outside.
It's true.
Either that or it's the Magimix for the cocktail.
It's the person that just bought that Picasso.
Hooray! And everyone embraces. And the champagne all round.
And the corks pop, yeah.
Exactly. We'll have to add that sound effect here when this
That's
becomes
fine.
A podcast.
I'm sure you can rustle that up.
Yeah, we can rustle that up. First questions first. Mm. It's day one, it's year one, it's hour three. You look very controlled. Am I dealing in sort of accurate physiognomy, or are you putting on a good show?
The whole process is a whole year, and you know, one of the hardest things, or the most important things, is getting the galleries in. And we have our gallery list in May, you know, and if you've got the best galleries, they then bring great work, and then the collectors come, and then they buy, you know, the whole cycle kind of gets underway. So while I'm not saying the last week hasn't been stress-free, it's been a long process, and, you know, this is like the day it all came together.
But this is kind of good, isn't it? It must be nice to see, not that it was going to be a surprise, but it's always an exciting moment, whether you're a journalist, whether you're doing it, or whether you're one of the people coming here to... obviously buy stuff, to look at stuff. It's nice to see a proper kind of ranch load of collectors out the front.
It really is. I mean, that was, yeah, obviously my sort of last sort of round of nervousness was, you know, are people going to come and buy? Because it's also somewhat out of my control, you know, dictated by the economy and things like that I, you know, don't really have a say in.
You don't have to, I mean, it's not like you have to be out the front with a golf sale sign. It's
fine. I didn't wear a sandwich board. It wasn't that bad. But it was really wonderful after an entire, you know, it's actually 2 years of work on this, to stand there at 3 o'clock and the doors opened and see collectors from all over the world come in. And not only that, but now, 3 hours in, as you say, people are buying things.
Yes, it's good,
Big
right?
sales are happening. Yeah, and it's working.
And does this help, for when you sort of wander around and you speak to the gallerists, this is obviously a big moment. This is the moment when everyone can sort of slightly sigh of relief. Is this sort of what might be called the magic hour at an art fair, when things start to kind of click, especially when it's sort of day one and year one?
Yeah, it kind of is, because there is, you know, there's an anticipation from so many people. You know, there's been a huge amount of press interest in the fair, which has been great. So people have been reading about it. It's something very new. It's a unique concept as well. It's this idea of sort of juxtaposing things from different periods of art history, all in a very contemporary environment, in a park. You know, no one's done this before. So I think, you know, that moment when everything's up, the collectors come in, and it all sort of comes together. Everyone's work sort of pays off in a very short space of time, and it is very exciting.
I texted my friend to see if he was here. He used to work for one of the galleries that you have here today, and he said, "Wow, that sounds great. It sounds like you're working too hard. Live radio for dead artists." and I did say that for him. But is it different dealing with when sort of Frieze seems like such a contemporary world? Is it different? Is it a different kettle of fish when you're dealing with galleries that deal in old masters and antiquities and things right up to modern? I mean, is that a very different conversation that's had with these people?
In some ways, yes, but there is still that common thread of interest. You know, they're all interested in art, and I think, you know, the people who deal in contemporary art probably actually very interested in coming and the work that's here. I've seen a lot of them here today, and I know that the old masters will all be down for his art fair tomorrow checking it out as well. So there is this sort of, you know, I think there is now especially, and one of the reasons for doing this fair is the feeling that people are starting to look more broadly at things, and there is an interest in seeing how things from different periods can be juxtaposed and actually give a much sort of richer context to the contemporary, or vice versa.
And I wondered about that, because we've heard that sort of collectors come and they're more interested. They might have a specialty, or they might have started off collecting one sort of thing, and now that they've branched out, whether through more money or more education or simply seeing something nice on someone else's wall, is that sort of who you're catering for, the sort of the ever curious, or is it also a canny decision?
It's a combination of various things. You know, one of the things this fair came out of was conversations with contemporary artists about what they're interested in. And inevitably it's old masters, or it's ancient art, or it's, you know, even work made in the mid-20th century. And that's really what inspires them and influences them. And actually, our talks programme is built around that. So, for example, you've got Cecily Brown in conversation with Nicholas Penny, director of the National Gallery. We've got Luke Toymans, Glenn Brown talking as well with curators. And they're talking about historical work in museums. And, you know, I think artists are in an amazing position to sort of give a really unusual perspective on historical art and actually open people's eyes to it and make it feel quite fresh and relevant.
And doing these talks is a great thing, because it's kind of like getting musicians to talk about music. They never like the thing that you're meant to like. They always like something that has a better beat. Is that what you found with doing these artist talks as well, that people, you're sometimes surprised, and you are we were talking to Axel Weervoort before, and he was talking about looking at art with childish eyes, almost, you know, rediscovering a little bit of ignorance, and just digging the beauty of something. Is that something that dealing with these artists is
Definitely. I mean, Jasper Sharp, who's curated our talks programme, said, you know, what's interesting about getting an artist's perspective on historical art is they don't have the same kind of deference necessarily.
Yeah.
That we, you know, we go to museums and we think, oh, well, this is important, so we must like it, and, you know, you mustn't criticise it because it's been selected and it's got through all these hundreds of years and is being held up as, you know, best examples. Whereas I think artists can be much more, they have much more critical eye. You know, there'll be some things in a museum that they'll, you know, think of, you know, every time they make a piece of work, or, and there'll be some things that just leave them cold and they're just not interested.
And it's nice when people have a surprising favourite.
Yeah, exactly. So I spent, in preparation for the talk, we've asked all the artists to spend time in the museum with the curator they're going to talk with. So the night before last, I spent 2 hours in the National Gallery with Nicholas Penny and Cecily Brown. It was closed, it was empty. Walking around looking at, you know, Piero della Francesca and
Degas. That's when you know you're doing the right job.
Oh my God, it was incredible. It was so, I mean, you know, these talks I think will be something really extraordinary, because just the, you know, the beginning of the discussion that was happening then between them, you know, I just think it's people will be really amazed. Like, people who know her work, it'll give them a completely different perspective on that and historical art, and vice versa, I think, you know. So I suppose what we're trying to do is that there are very many different worlds in this fair in terms of dealers from completely different places, and we are bringing them together and see what happens.
We're going to play a hippie song. I mean, we don't have time. I was going to play like Happy Family. I was going to play because that's nice, isn't it? That's a nice message.
Before we go, chill me out at the end of a stressful.
Before
day.
We go, I wanted to ask you about how involved you have to be, especially when it's the first year, on what people have on their stands. I think that's something everyone wants to know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, do you have to go, ooh, a bit less of that, or why don't you try this?
We have quite a strict selection process. Mm. So we get a lot of applications for the fair, and people apply with a proposal for what they want to bring. And then we have a committee, and we sit down in a room for 2 days and lock the door, and no one leaves until we've decided. We've been through all the applications in great detail and decide which galleries get into the fair. So the same thing counts with the contemporary fair. It's a really kind of thorough selection process. So they send in a proposal for what they're going to show, and they get selected on that basis. So,
and in terms of what people have on their stand, do you get involved in that?
We have a vetting process which took place yesterday, which is kind of fascinating.
Victoria Siddle and her big stick.
Is that what it is? It was more esteemed panel of museum curators. I didn't get involved, you know, it's not my speciality. But it was interesting. And, you know, and a couple of works don't pass the test. Always happens in fairs, apparently. We're pretty strict about it. But what I want is for people to be able to come. And they might know nothing about Oceanic tribal art. They might know nothing about, you know, early Italian Renaissance painting. But they know that whatever they see in this fair has passed that, has gone through that sort of process. So museum experts have looked at it. And if they want to buy it, they know that it's sort of what it says on the label.
It does exactly what it says on the tin. I think we're going to leave it there, aren't we? Victoria Siddle, thank you so much for joining us on this. It's also our first time we've been live from Frieze, so thank you for having us under your tent.
It's the first of many.
Yeah, indeed. Have a lovely rest of fair.
Thank you very
much. I'm sure it'll be chilled. It'll be fine. And that brings us to the end of our special live Midori House show here at Frieze Masters. The fun isn't over yet. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from the alternative, or the contemporary Frieze Art Fair itself, as it opens its doors to the international art world. More critics, gallerists, buyers, analysts and artists to come. Today's show has been produced by Katie Wilbur, with special thanks to Paul Noble, Jack Phillips, Tom Edwards and everyone here at Frieze Masters. If you've missed anything, the show will be available to download at monocle.com via iTunes or our mobile app
app up next. It's the latest edition of Section D. That's Hugo McDonald's show. In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours London time, Andrew Miller and Marcus Hippie will be back with the Monocle Daily. I've been Robert Bounds. I'm off to have a large glass of fizzy pop. See you at the same time tomorrow down at Freeze. Thanks for tuning in.